The Guardian. Food is the stuff of life. We bond over a candlelit meal, we daydream about what to have for our lunch, and crave all sorts. Salt and vinegar crisps are my affliction. But how does the food we eat affect our health? For a long time, we've known about the link between diet and diseases like obesity, diabetes, and heart disease. But now, scientists are wondering whether we could eat to treat other illnesses.
You know, there is a lot to learn, but I think that in the end, we'll find that diet will have an impact on virtually every aspect of health and disease.
Top oncologists from around the world are beginning to research the role of diet in helping to treat cancer.
Well, one alternative that's emerged very powerfully in the last decade or so is to say that the cancer cell does not grow in isolation, that it lives in a particular home, and that home is also a target.
How do you target cancer cells without affecting the surrounding healthy tissue? And why is this approach better than our current methods? I'm Hannah Devlin. This is Science Weekly.
My name is Siddhartha Mukherjee. I'm an associate professor of medicine in cancer medicine or oncology at Columbia University in New York City.
So we've all heard about cancer. We probably know people that have had cancer. But could you just tell me what it is from a biological point of view?
Cancer is a cellular disease where the fundamental abnormality is that the cells don't know how to stop dividing, or in some case, they don't know how to stop dying. And this process of being unable to have regulated cell division causes the cells to divide abnormally, and abnormal cell division eventually gives rise to a tumor. The main reason behind what's driving the abnormal cellular division is alterations in genes that generally regulate cell division, but can also regulate other aspects of the biology of a cell, such as metabolism or growth.
And how do these genetic changes that turn the cells malignant start out in the first place?
There are four or five main causes that make these genetic changes possible. First, you can acquire these genetic changes because of carcinogens such as tobacco smoke or radiation altering your DNA and thereby introducing mutations. That's one. Number two is you could inherit a gene from your parents, thereby increasing your risk for cancer. Number three, viruses could introduce new genetic material into cells or change your cellular physiology, thereby causing mutations. And number four, you can get these mutations by accident. When cells divide, they make copies of their DNA, and just like any copying machine, the copying machine can have accidents, and so you can get an accident. Sometimes the accidents can be increased in frequency by factors such as inflammation or mutations in other genes. But those are basically the four main causes by which you can accumulate genetic mutations that ultimately unleash malignant cellular growth in cells.
One of the ways we've treated cancer previously is with what Siddhartha calls the lock and key approach. He explains this using the analogy of a car that's speeding out of control.
Imagine a car. A normal cell undergoes regulated cell division. Cancer is a cell where the accelerator is jammed or the brake has been snapped. The car keeps moving forward.
The fix is simple. You need to shut off the engine, take the car keys, turn it off, and your car decelerates. But every key is made for a specific car. So each lock and key is bespoke. This key won't work for another car. This is how some cancer drugs work. They can only gain access to the innards of a cell with a particular key. If the cell it comes across doesn't have a compatible lock, there's not much it can do. So it leaves healthy cells intact and only affects the malignant ones.
And one example of that would be the drug Gleevec or imatinib, where it really fits in. It's a small molecule that we, that human beings designed, that goes and fits into one of these driver engines within a cell, within a blood cell in this case, and shuts it off, much like an ignition key can go and shut off a car that has a jammed accelerator.
And that sounds like a sensible approach to take. Are there any limitations with it, though?
Well, there's several limitations with it. One limitation is that cancer cells can become resistant to these lock and key mechanisms. So there are thousands of mechanisms by which a cancer cell can become resistant. The other one, that's another problem, is that these lock and keys have been hard to find. They, you know, sometimes, you know, you can find the engines that are driving a cancer cell, and you can find an exquisitely specific key to shut off that engine. But it's like looking for a key. Sometimes you can't find the key in the box of all human chemicals that we've invented or can invent. And that's a problem. And the third problem is that, in general, cancers are very diverse. Individual cancers have individual engine drivers, as it were. And so for each individual cancer, you would want to find its unique lock and key. And that creates a problem of trying to find, you know, hundreds of thousands of such examples, or at least thousands of such examples, because of the diversity of cancers. So all three of them, resistance, the diversity of cancer, and the capacity to not find appropriate locks and keys, have been limiting or have limited our capacity to deliver exquisitely targeted therapy for most cancers.
Mm-hmm. And so are there alternative approaches that we can take that we should be looking at?
Well, one alternative that's emerged very powerfully in the last decade or so is to say that the cancer cell does not grow in isolation, that it lives in a particular home, and that home is what is also a target. Much like the cancer cell itself is a target, its altered genes are targets, the home that the cancer cell builds around itself is also a target. So one of the questions then becomes, well, what are the components of that home? What are the components of the microenvironment, or the environment that the cancer cell lives in?
One of the key components of this home is nutrition. A malignant cell can't grow in isolation. It needs things from its environment. So the question many scientists are asking is, what does a cancer cell need to grow? Is the nutrition profile different from healthy cells? And if so, can we change what we eat to slow a cancer's growth or spread?
And our hope is that we can understand what the differences are between the way that cancer cells make their nutrients and normal cells, and we can maybe try to target that difference in the cancer cell to have some therapy that will specifically affect the cancer cell.
After the break, we'll be looking at why diet could be a promising tool to treat cancer and many other diseases. We'll be back in a moment after this.
This Saturday, in The Guardian's Weekend magazine, there's an exclusive interview with America's former First Lady, Michelle Obama. She answers questions from politicians, pop stars and artists, including Miley Cyrus, Katy Perry, Sadiq Khan, and a group of school kids. She also talks about the women who inspire her, meeting the Queen, life in the White House, and lots more. Pick up The Guardian tomorrow to read the full interview, or get it online at theguardian.com.
Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Hannah Devlin. Before the break, we began to think about the different ways we could treat cancer. Instead of targeting a cell with a lock and key approach, could we look at the environment of the tumour, or what Siddhartha calls its home? One promising way to do that is by looking at our diet and modifying what we eat. Could this be a promising avenue for treating cancer? And could this approach treat other diseases too?
I'm Professor Karen Valsden. I'm a group leader and scientist at the Francis Crick Institute in London, and I'm also the chief scientist for Cancer Research UK.
We began by talking about a cancer's home and where malignant cells get their food from.
Proliferate normally. Cancer cells use a lot of nutrients that are provided through the bloodstream. They also have specific changes in the way that they can make their own nutrients that vary from cancer to cancer. And our hope is that we can understand what the differences are between the way that cancer cells make their nutrients and normal cells, and we can maybe try to target that difference in the cancer cell to have some therapy that will specifically affect the cancer cell.
So you're saying that they're not just sort of guzzling up more nutrients, they have a different profile of things that they need and a different way that they use these nutrients.
That's right, they do. But unfortunately, it's not the same in every cancer. May not even be the same in every cancer subtype in a particular tumour type. So it's not as easy as to say cancers are different from normal cells, or even breast cancers are different from normal breast tissue. There's lots of different ways in which they're different. So we need to understand how all of these different changes help cancers to grow.
So have scientists started to identify some of those differences, and have they pinpointed special things that only cancer cells need, or that they need a lot more of compared to ordinary healthy cells?
Well, we're in the process of doing that. It's very exciting times in this area. So we've been particularly interested in a particular group of nutrients called amino acids. And you know, amino acids are really important because they're the building blocks of proteins. I think everyone's heard of proteins. We know that all aspects of life need proteins. Amino acids generally fall into two groups. There's the ones that we call essential, which means that cells can't make them. You have to get them from your diet. They have to be provided. And then there's the non-essential amino acids, which can come either from the diet or cells can make their own. So that's the group that we're interested in, the non-essential amino acids. And there's lots of evidence now that many of the ways in which cells take up or use or produce the non-essential amino acids can be different in the cancers than in the normal tissue. So this is what we're trying to target.
And have you got any particular examples of that?
Our work is really focused on different amino acids, in particular an amino acid called serine.
Serine is found in most dietary protein, things like eggs, meat and fish. But cancerous cells become more reliant on dietary sources of serine than healthy cells. It's something that Karen and her colleagues are now investigating.
So if you don't eat any more serine, there's not going to be any serine available, and we think that's going to disproportionately be harmful to the cancer cells.
So you're not suggesting that this kind of diet could cure cancer by itself. This is a tool that scientists and doctors are looking at in the hope that it might make current treatments even more powerful in treating cancer.
That's exactly the way we're thinking. So at the moment, we're thinking that the diet may be helpful in the context of the types of therapies that people are already getting. But of course, what we're also looking for is other types of therapies and new types of drugs that might cooperate with this diet even more effectively, so have an even bigger beneficial effect. We like the plan because we think that not only will the diets make the therapies more effective, but it may even allow us to use less severe chemotherapeutic regimes so that people aren't so ill during their therapies.
And how far along is this work? Have you got to the point of being able to trial this in patients, or is it still very much a work in progress?
Well, so we're talking about the serine-free diet. We're really at the point where we've convinced ourselves that it will work, and we've shown that it does work in some preclinical models. And we're kind of ready to start thinking about how do we develop the right type of diet, and how do we really investigate whether we can get the kind of therapeutic benefit that we have seen in other models in patients. So we haven't gone into patients yet, but I think we're just about ready to do so.
Serine isn't the only dietary compound of interest. There's also asparagine, an amino acid that's found in asparagus and potatoes. One study in mice found that asparagine made breast cancer more likely to spread to other parts of the body. Another animal study looked at insulin, a hormone which regulates your blood sugar levels. It too found that insulin affects how cancer cells proliferate and spread in animals.
We're hoping that the first patients will start in December.
This work led Siddhartha to embark on a clinical trial in patients to determine whether a diet that keeps insulin levels low can make cancer drugs more effective. It's a really exciting and new area of research. However, this work has been done in the lab with animal models, not people. And different diets seem to affect different cancers. It's not a one-size-fits-all approach. And this is why Karen is cautious.
We really don't want to encourage people to try and take these approaches themselves at this point. We think it's promising, but certainly I would encourage anyone to take the advice of their oncologist, try and have a healthy diet. But we don't know whether this is going to be the answer, and quite honestly, we don't know if it's going to make things better. So we're very keen that everything that we do in patients should be underpinned by really strong evidence. We're terming it precision nutrition. So what we want is not for people to just take these diets because they've heard of something or someone's told them that this or that is a good idea. But we really want to be able to come and say we have very firm evidence based on which we can be completely confident that the advice that we're giving is the right advice and will help people. And I'm afraid we're just not at that point just now.
Time will tell how effective this precision nutrition will be. But Siddhartha is optimistic that this approach to medicine could go beyond just cancer.
We know now that diet is a molecule, a set of molecules, and it changes the nutrient milieu of a cell. And so some of the principles would be specific to cancer, but some of them would be quite general. You know, should we be using diet to alter metabolic diseases like heart disease? Well, we've been trying for a long time, but now there's a renewed interest in trying to figure out specific components of human diet. Imagine building human diet from scratch. Not because, you know, your ancestors have handed down that you eat grains and proteins in this manner, but imagine the capacity to build human diets from scratch, molecule by molecule, and figuring out which ones could be drivers of certain kinds of disease and which ones could prevent other kinds of disease. So there are very, very broad applications. It's just an infancy in our ability to look at this very exciting area of diet.
Many thanks to both Siddhartha Mukherjee and Karen Vousden for joining us. Links to their work can be found on our website, theguardian.com/podcasts. And if you have any thoughts or queries in the meantime, you can email scienceweekly@theguardian.com. Science Weekly was produced by Greya Jackson and presented by me, Hannah Devlin. Until next time, goodbye from me and the rest of the team.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.